Since the 1800s, Hickok & Boardman Insurance Group has been providing quality service and peace of mind to our clients. With our offices in Burlington, Stowe, and St. Albans, and our Dennis Ricker & Brown offices in Montpelier and Lynnonville, we are here when you need us.
And now WDEV-FM and AM presents our two-hour public affairs program, Open Mic with Mike Smith. Important topics, topical guests, and your phone calls. And now here's the host of Open Mic, Mike Smith.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us this morning. Really appreciate taking some time to listen to us. We're going to continue our discussion today with candidates for governor. The primary is next Tuesday, and it's crunch time. Today, we'll speak with the Republicans, Phil Scott, candidate for governor, and Bruce Lissman, also both Republican candidates for governor. Up first is Phil Scott, and I want to welcome to Phil Scott to our WDEV studios. Good morning, Phil.
Good morning, Mike.
By the way, happy birthday.
Thanks. Thanks very much. It's something I have in common, actually, with Jeff Gordon. And I was reminded today, Barack Obama as well. So three totally different people, but we share a birthday.
Yeah, let's get right to it. Your opponent, Bruce Lissman, claims you are Shumlin's wingman in his ads and in things that he says. How do you respond?
Well, it's unfortunate that this campaign has turned into this type of tone, negative tone, I believe. And worrying more about tearing me apart and degrading me and my ethics and my respect that I have amongst many in order to make himself look better. And I think that's totally unnecessary and something that Vermonters don't expect. I've been in office now as lieutenant governor for three terms, the same time that Governor Shumlin was elected as well. And I'm the only statewide Republican office holder in the state. It's fairly lonely there, if you might imagine. And when you're first elected, when you're elected ever into office of any sort, I've watched many people transition from being politicians to being true public servants. And I aspire to do that as well. It's something that I think that we all need to do more of. I think the better leaders are the ones that do that. It's not a stepping stone to something else. It's about providing public service, taking care of your constituents, doing what's best for them. And at that point in time, you get beyond the election and you do whatever you can to help, help Vermont. And that's my only goal, is to help Vermont. And I believe that the future is about focusing on the economy, making Vermont more affordable, and restoring faith and trust. This faith and trust has been lost throughout our nation and here in Vermont. And I, again, that's my main goal. Those three are goals of mine and something that I'm very proud of in my years of service.
One of your opponent's commercials questions your business ties to state government. Basically, what it says is that your construction company is getting state contract while you're I don't know if it's a millionaire or multimillionaire that it says that you are. How do you respond to that?
Well, it's coming from a multimillionaire. I think that was somewhat humorous, calling me a millionaire when my net worth is worth maybe half of what his house is. So I thought that was unfortunate. Obviously, Bruce is once again trying to mislead Vermonters about my record and degrade my family's business. I'm part of a family business, and he's using D.C.-style tactics to do so. My personal integrity means more to me than anything else, and I believe we should put principle above politics. I think that's something that's missing in this country and in this state. And so I believe I've said there's nothing that says I have to put the business aside when I become governor. But I believe it's the right thing to do. So I've worked with a Burlington firm who has the expertise in these issues, and they put an agreement together that will be put into effect upon my being sworn into office. And it's a blind trust, and it will totally, totally separate me from the business, and I'll have absolutely no involvement whatsoever. I will not profit from the business whatsoever, and I'll follow whatever rules there are. I'm going to follow them. That's the way I'm made. That's what I think we should do. And you can talk to anyone who's worked with me in the business or in politics, and they know that that's part of my MO, that I'm trusted, respected, and it's adherence to that and the integrity and the respect that I think is so important.
One of the things that you're not going to this, if you are the eventual winner in the primary, this is not going to be the last time you hear about this issue, I suspect.
Well, I think the Democrats have certainly already taken off on that, maybe through the suggestion of the Lisman campaign, but they've already issued statements about this, the Democratic Party. I think I'm the only candidate standing in the way of them retaining the governorship. And I know that they are seizing this opportunity to make sure that this becomes an issue so that if they could put me away in the primary, this would be the biggest gift to the Democratic Party in this century.
So the solution from their point of view is for you to get rid of the family business. Is that a solution from your point?
Well, you know, I'm a co-owner of the business. I'm not the owner. And it's something that I don't aspire to do anything more. You know, I'm not going to move up into politics. This isn't something, this isn't a stepping stone to something else. I actually would like to go back to something after I do the rest of my public service. And I think that's important. I think that again, having that experience, living paycheck to paycheck, wondering about how you're going to make your payroll, where the next job's going to come from, it's all part of my chemical makeup. And it's part of what I think I bring to the table about the struggles that Vermonters face. I certainly can sympathize with them. I've been there. And I think that, I'm going to put it into a blind trust, totally separate. I think it's the right thing to do. I want to restore faith and trust. I believe that that's necessary for us to move forward on the economy, again, the affordability of Vermont. And those are two issues that we should be focusing like a laser on. Rather than talking about issues like this, we should be talking about what we can bring to the table. What are we going to do for Vermonters? We don't need to raise taxes and fees on people anymore. They're already burdened enough. We face some huge challenges in the state, and I believe I have the vision to bring us forward.
I've taken a lot of heat because I've said on this show and other shows and other programs that negative campaigning works. We think we're pure in Vermont. But negative campaigning works. Does it work?
Well, unfortunately, I think it does. You know, I've just chosen a different path. I don't believe that it's necessary. I don't want to do it. It's not something that's that I want to do something that that my children, my family, my wife, my mom, you know, I want them to be proud of me and my friends. And I don't think that gives them anything to be proud of. And I think it's a sense of power and ego. I think that that's what drives this, that you aspire to do something and you'll let nothing stand in your way of accomplishing that. Spending millions of dollars to campaign, negative ads, mistruths, falsifying. It's just, that's not part of what I think politics should be about. And if we want to repair the dysfunction in D.C., We all take a look at D.C. and we say Washington-style politics, and we think it's so dysfunctional, so polarized. If we want to change that, we better start acting appropriately right here in our own backyard. If we want to aspire to be something different, then be different. And I choose a different path.
Have you changed your mind on Donald Trump?
No. There's nothing that Donald Trump has done that changed my mind. I've been quite clear on that. I can't support him. I know that could be detrimental to me in this campaign, but I do so with my eyes wide open. I think you need to put I think it's principle above politics. You know, I love my country more than I want to aspire to be something else in politics. And I think that that's necessary. I think nothing has changed my mind. In fact, some of the things that have been done over the last couple of weeks have just solidified that.
Let's turn to Vermont issues here. The Democrats have sort of tied themselves up in knots on this wind issue, and particularly what we're talking about is the siting of industrial wind on ridgelines. What's your position?
Yeah, I'm not in favor of any more industrial wind on our ridgelines. I remember when after the first phase went in, I was, as you know, I do quite a bit of cycling, and I was cycling up in Craftsbury through Craftsbury Common, coming down over into Albany. And it was after the first phase went through, and I looked up, and I couldn't believe the magnitude of the wind generators that were up there. I don't know what it was that I expected, but it wasn't that. And I thought, how unfortunate that we're destroying, I believe, our ridgelines. And I don't think it's sufficient power, to be honest. And it's ripping Vermont apart. And it's so unnecessary. I say, let's not do any more ridgeline development. I think Governor Douglas actually had it right. And we should not move forward in any way that. In fact, I would use my power. I would hope that the legislature would put a moratorium on any more ridgeline development. But if that doesn't happen, I would use my power, executive order, to stop it while I'm in office.
Is the PSB, the Public Service Board, process broken? And if so, how would you fix it?
I believe that there it should be allowed to function. It's a quasi-judicial body. It was formed, and you may have been part of it when you were there, but it was formed to take politics out of energy issues. And I think that, unfortunately, I think there is some connection now. I think the governor should stay out of the Public Service Board. I know you appoint the members, but at the same time, allow them to do their work. And if we need to change the law and they have to adhere to the law, then change it in order to do so. But it's a quasi-judicial body, and they should be neutral and objective.
But let me give you this scenario. Let's suppose you appoint the Public Service Board, and you're an opponent of wind, or industrial wind on ridgelines. And the Public Service Board rules that they will approve projects for industrial wind. Would you interfere?
No. No. I think it should be objective, neutral, transparent. I think that's part of, you know, how you restore the faith and trust in government by not getting involved, allowing them to do their work. Would I be disappointed? Absolutely. Would I voice my opinion? Absolutely. But it's not something that I think you should interfere with.
I interviewed this week the gubernatorial candidates on the Democratic side and gun control. There's varying positions on gun control on that side between the various candidates. What's your position on gun control?
I don't believe that we need to change our gun laws in Vermont. I've been quite clear on that. I'm a gun owner myself, a long time hunter, outdoorsman, and I believe they're sufficient. I think we should make sure that we enforce the laws that are on the books at this point in time, but I don't think we need anything further.
Let's talk about Lake Champlain. The EPA saying you got to clean it up. It's going to cost millions, maybe hundreds of millions of dollars to clean it up. Where are you going to find the money?
Well, it's going to come over time. This didn't happen overnight. It's not going to be repaired overnight, but we need to move forward on that. The administration, Douglas administration, had started the cleanup with Clean and Clear. I know that many of the Democrats say that it was ineffective. I would disagree that it was a step in the right direction. I think there are other areas that we need to work towards. I think we need to work as partners with the dairy community, the farmers. We shouldn't throw them under the bus, but we should work in partnership with them. I think the digesters that are contemplated for farming, I think that's great. I think it's a great use of resources. We should work with them on that. Injection of manure into some of the fields, crop rotation, buffers, and so forth, best management practices. But the dairy industry is big here, and it's part of our tradition. It's part of our backbone. And I don't think we need to clean up Lake Champlain. But we need to do it together.
But some of the farmers are upset with the new water rules. How would you walk that balance between making sure that we clean up Lake Champlain and making sure that the farmers aren't put out of business?
Yeah, again, we need to protect the industry, and we need to work with them, not against them, not force them without trying to work in tandem. I think I've actually met with many farmers, and many of them, particularly the large farms, to be honest, are doing it right now. They're using the injection process. They are rotating their crops. They're doing things in different ways. So I think, again, we need to work together with them. It's another industry for Vermont, a very important industry and part of our culture. And so we'll find a way through this, but we need to do it in a measured way over the next number of years. This isn't going to be cleaned up overnight. It's going to take decades to do this.
Before we turn to the general fund, let's turn to the transportation fund. Do you believe in an increase in the gas tax?
No.
What about the mileage tax that you spoke about?
Well, that was taken completely out of context and really unfortunate. And again, that's what happens in politics. But the question was, and I remember one of the candidates has spoken about, the question was about future transportation needs. How do we pay for our infrastructure? Where are we going in the future and so forth and so on? And one of the candidates had mentioned that they drove an electric vehicle and didn't actually pay anything into the transportation fund to restore and rebuild our crumbling infrastructure. And I thought, how unfortunate that the rest of us are paying with a gas tax. But those driving electric vehicles, those driving vehicles with natural gas, and, you know, who knows what's going to happen in the future with hydrogen and so forth. There's going to be different technology that's going to change the way we do things. So what we're doing now is paying per gallon of gasoline. And if as we transition away from that, as the vehicles get more efficient, there's less and less money going into that. So I said on a national basis, Congress has been talking about this. They've been talking about different concepts of how do we transition away from the per gallon tax, because it's not enough right now. It's a user fee, but it's not enough. So I had mentioned that they had talked about, I think it was a Republican congressman, chair of the committee, had talked about a mileage tax. So I'd said that's one of the concepts that they're talking about. But I am not, I want to be totally, totally clear, advocating for an additional tax on Vermonters. We're already overburdened, overtaxed right now. We're facing this crisis of affordability, and we need to stop. So it's not something I'm advocating for. It's just something Congress has been talking about. There is going to have to be talk about it, tough decisions made in the future about parity.
We're speaking with Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott. If you wish to join the conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. That's Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott and Republican gubernatorial candidate Phil Scott. Let's get into some broader issues here. One of the things that I'm trying to understand is each candidate's position on healthcare, their vision on healthcare, because it is a major part of our economy. And if you look at healthcare, if you could take a magic wand and design the healthcare system that you think is appropriate for Vermonters that would guarantee access, affordability, and quality, can you give me a sense of what that healthcare system would look like?
Well, it wouldn't look like what we have today. I can guarantee you that. This dysfunctional healthcare exchange that we have now, this IT system, is we need to pull the plug on that. It's just not working. And I know there's been hundreds of millions of dollars spent on it already. But it's time to say enough is enough, and we need to do something different. So we need to transition to something else, another, whether it's the federal exchange or going to a different model. I'd like to see an approach where we work with other states so that we don't go it alone on everything that we do, and actually share in some of the maintenance costs over time. Creating more opportunity, more competition, I think is necessary. Possibly working with other states that we can create more of a broader base so that spread the burden amongst many. But I think that we also need to transition from the old fee-for-service model to a payment system that compensates providers for outcomes and value. Let's take care of the patients in some way instead of manipulating the system. So in some way, finding out ways to so you can pay somebody more. We need to take care of the patient. So that's going to be a model that is going to have to change over time, and it's a culture change as well in the way we deliver services.
Do you believe in single-payer system?
No, I don't. In fact, that was from the very beginning. I know that Governor Shumlin ran on this issue 6 or 7 years ago. It propelled him into the office, as a matter of fact. There was, as you recall, he was involved in a very contested primary. He won by maybe 100 votes. And I think he won because of single payer. He convinced people that this was the best thing since sliced bread. But he didn't convince the rest of us. And I was trying to be objective. I was saying, prove it to me. Show us what this thing's going to look like. Show us. Tell us how much it's going to cost. And then describe how we're going to pay for it. Just three basic questions. And in 6 years, he was never able to do so until at the end, it wasn't politically necessary for him to continue with this. And he said, it's not going to work for us. And in the meantime, I think it had the most detrimental effect on our economy of anything that I can think of. Because what I heard from employers that were thinking about expanding, employers that were thinking about coming here to Vermont, they would consistently ask, what are you doing with your healthcare system? We're hearing this 15, 16, 17% payroll tax. We can't afford that. So what they did was they waited. You know, they said those who are here and thinking about expanded just sat on their hands and said, we're not going to do anything until we know what's going to happen with this, because we know we can't be competitive with our neighbors. We can't be competitive on a national basis. If you impose this 15, 16, 17% payroll tax on us, we're not going to be able to survive. So they didn't expand, and those companies didn't come to Vermont. So, again, we need to focus on the economy. We need to make sure that Vermont's more affordable. And we need to restore that faith and trust and consistency in state government that we're lacking.
I want to come back to healthcare, but we've got full lines here. So let's try to take some of the phone calls. Let's go to Pete in Barry. Pete, you're on open mic with gubernatorial candidate Phil Scott.
Yes, good morning, Mike, and good morning, Lieutenant Governor. First of all, I'd like to say I'm a fan, but I have a question regarding gun control. A little bit ago, you said you would not change any of the laws in Vermont regarding gun control. And I wanted to ask you, as a hunter myself, or former hunter, I should say, what is the need for 15-clip, 25-clip, 50-clip magazines when, at least years ago, the law stated that you could only have, I think, 6 rounds in your gun for deer hunting, and even now bird hunters, at least waterfowl bird hunters, I think are limited to 3 in their shotguns.
Let's go to his question.
No, I agree.
Thanks,
Pete. In terms of the limits on for duck hunting, I think it's 3. And as well, you know, you question the need for having magazines that carry that much, but that's not the problem. You know, I believe that the issues that are revolving around some of the anger, mental health issues that we face that were across the country are part of the problem. It's not the gun. It's not the magazine limits. They find ways of creating harm to our citizens. Look at what happened in France. All they did was rent a truck and ran over people. I mean, look what they've done with 9/11. They took over planes and created a disaster for our country. So they will seek means of causing harm to our citizens, and it's something bigger than the gun itself. So I don't think that creating limits on magazines or changing our laws here in Vermont are going to make us any safer.
Let's go to Gail in Calais. Gail, you're on open mic with gubernatorial candidate Phil Scott.
Good morning, Mike. Good morning, Phil, and thank you for taking my call. And I just wanted to let you know that one of the main reasons I'm supporting Phil for governor is because I know that you will be the candidate that will resist higher taxes and fees and truly move Vermont forward. And that is very, personally, very, very important for me. I want to stay living here in Vermont, but I'm not sure with the way things are going now if I'll be able to. And one more just quick comment is I am very, very disappointed in the negative tactics and campaigning of your opponent. And I think people should take a good look at his background. Thank you.
Thank you, Gail. Let me ask you this question following up on Gail. One of the things that your opponent talks about is the increase in the state budget, which has been significant over the last few years. Why didn't you stop that?
Well, if I could have, I would have. No doubt about it. As I mentioned before, I'm the only statewide Republican office holder. For those who don't realize that it's an elected, a separately elected position, we have two people in the office, myself and one other, and an intern. Our total budget is around $170,000. We have no power or authority over the administration. Any of the departments that we have or agencies have no power whatsoever, don't have any power over the legislature other than presiding over the Senate. And presiding over the Senate means you're a judicial body, you're a traffic cop making sure that that things move forward. But I don't have that magic wand. And if I could have, I would have. I've worked with in tandem with Don Turner, the minority leader in the House, as well as Joe Benning in the Senate. We tried to do whatever we could to stop what was happening, knowing that we're spending at a rate of 5% growth, over-optimistic in their expectations, and when the revenue was growing at a much reduced rate. And that's why I've advocated for, let's look back. We don't have to guess at what the revenue is going to grow. Let's look back at what the revenue actually did grow last year. Let's look at what the economy grew, what wages grew, and let's tie that. If it grew at 1%, let's limit the growth of the budget to 1% or reduce it. You know, that's what we can do. Let's tighten our belts and let's go back to the fundamentals, live within our means, just like we do in our own households, just like we do in our own businesses, and we'll get through this because we're Vermonters, we're frugal, we can make this work.
Let's go to the phone lines. I would just ask the callers if you could just sort of make it really brief in terms of your question or comment. We've got them all stacked up here, and I got to go to break in just a moment. Let's go to Bill in Barry. Bill, if you could just make it concise, I would certainly appreciate it. You're on with gubernatorial candidate Phil Scott.
Hi, Phil. Quickly, my wife and I went up to town clerk, and after we got your brochure to say to do it, and we've already voted for you. And I will say this, as far as to what to do about Mr. Trump, we don't think we're going to vote in for president in the general election. We don't know. This thing and what Bruce Lipson is doing, and I was going to ask you about that too, but you already answered the thing about the mileage tax, and you have a very good point. And if people would only listen to you, they couldn't help but say you're the best candidate.
Thanks, Bill, for your phone call.
Well, thank you very much. Getting back again to Mr. Trump just a little bit. Some of the things, my dad was a World War II vet, disabled vet, and I have a deep amount of respect and appreciation for anybody that served in the military and what they did, the sacrifices for us. And when Mr. Trump, degrades them, I think he takes a real shot at all of us. So I find that very offensive.
Let's go to Stowe. Tom, I can't read that name, so let's just go to Stowe. You're on open mic with gubernatorial candidate Phil Scott.
Hi, yes. My name is Anna Chimino Burke. Good morning, Mike, Lieutenant Governor Scott.
Good morning.
I have a quick question. I'm deeply concerned about the rhetoric surrounding access to reproductive health care coming from Republicans this election. Would you protect the way women currently access abortion care in our state, or would you, like the Republican presidential ticket, support laws that limit access to abortion in Vermont? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, I'm a pro-choice Republican, always have been, and I believe that we need to allow a woman's right to choose.
Let's go to Chris in Waterbury. Chris, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Yes, good morning, Mike, and good morning, Lieutenant Governor.
Good morning.
You mentioned, I heard two callers back talk about a mileage tax, and I missed a conversation about that. As a board member in Waterbury, one of my big concerns is the municipality's infrastructure is deteriorating at such rapid rates that we don't have the wherewithal to pay to catch up. I had recently spoke with one of our local legislators in reference to a possible gas tax, one-time gas tax with maybe a five-year sunset, or based on gas prices going up. If they hit a certain limit, it would automatically come off. And I was hoping to see if that money could possibly go right towards the towns as opposed to state roads or federal roads, because we don't have any way, because of the education tax being so high, and I totally understand the cost of living in this state, and but I don't know what to do with this about this problem, because it's going to be biting us really hard here.
Thanks, Chris, for your phone call. Again, Chris is calling for...
Yeah, no gas tax. Let's just put that right off the table. But I do think that we can do some things to have a more efficient process. I do believe that the local communities do a great job in trying to bring more of those capital projects to the forefront and do it more in a more efficient process. So I'd be an advocate for at least making sure that they get their fair share, and as long as they use it for capital needs.
We're speaking with gubernatorial candidate and Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott. We'll continue our conversation and our discussion with the Lieutenant Governor in just a moment. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. In studio with us this morning is gubernatorial candidate Phil Scott. If you wish to join our conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Got full phone lines here, Phil, and so let's go right back to the phone lines. Fred from Newberry. Fred, you're on Open Mic. Good morning.
Hey, Phil. In 10 years, because the kids are leaving the state to find jobs, my theory is in 10 years, Vermont's going to be the largest national forest in the East, because no one can afford to live here. What say you?
Yeah, I agree. If we don't make changes, if we don't focus on the economy and make Vermont more affordable, we're going to continue down this path. What's happened is we have a stagnant population, 620,000 people plus, been that way for a couple of decades. But what's changing is the demographics, and you're absolutely right. We're losing our youth. We've lost 30,000 people out of the category from 25 to 45 since the last census. And when you think about what that represents, that's the workforce. And our workforce has shrunk, by the way. So 30,000 less. Those folks are the ones that buy homes, have families, utilize services, buy products, and then they pay taxes. So if there's 30,000 less of them, 5% of our population is putting the burden on the rest of us. And if we continue down this spiraled path, then we're going to lead to more problems in our future. So that's why I'm saying we need to focus on the economy, focus on making Vermont more affordable, and then we'll have a brighter future.
Let's go to Jack in Bridport. Jack, you're on Open Mic. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike. Good morning, Phil.
Good morning.
I love your stance on gun control there. That's some common sense that I keep hearing from the Democrats, but they don't make common sense when it comes to gun control. We got 20,000 laws on the book already, and here you got Obama letting people out of jail now that have committed crimes with guns. But my question is, what are you going to do about property taxes, Phil? We're senior citizens, and every year they go up 10-12%.
You're absolutely right, and that's part of this affordability issue that I keep talking about. And in particular, those on fixed incomes, those who are retired or trying to retire here in Vermont. I was speaking to a fellow up, and I did a little barbecue up at a dealership up in St. Jay. And I recognized him from the past, and I said, geez, I thought you retired. He said, no, I'm working, 72 years old, I'm working. And I said, well, that's good. I can imagine. I don't want to retire either. He says, I'm not doing it because I want to work. He said, I'm doing it because I have to. I can't afford my property taxes anymore. So here's the problem. You know, it's part of this whole demographic that I keep talking about, this aging population, stagnation of population, and the affordability of Vermont. What's happening is we're educating 20,000 less kids than we were 20 years ago, 86,000 kids, and it's costing us $1.6 billion to do it. There has to be other ways. We're going to have to think outside the box. We're going to have a 21st century education, more interactive learning, sharing of resources, consolidating of some schools and supervisory unions. We're going to have to do it different. We have a lot of smart people in this state. And I would say if we went to any group and we said we had 86,000 kids, here's $1.6 billion to educate them, I would advocate that we wouldn't be doing it the same way we're doing it today if we could start over. So we're going to have to think about that and how we deliver quality education for a much, much more reasonable price.
Do you support Act 46?
Act 46 wouldn't have been something that I would have crafted. But I've heard the screams of property tax relief for the last decade. And the lack of inaction on the part of the legislature has been a problematic. They have done nothing. Finally, they came up with something, Act 46, and it was hurried in the last bit of the legislative session, but it was a start, and it started a dialogue, and it's not perfect. It needs to be fixed. We need to clarify school choice. I think school choice is important. I think competition is good. I believe that these school districts that are going through having these tough talks about what they do to cut down the cost of education should be rewarded in some way. I believe they should be able to share in some of the savings. If they can consolidate, they can make some changes. They should share in those in their local communities. But so there should be some changes to Act 46, but at least it started the dialogue, because without Act 46, I don't think anybody would be talking about doing anything to cut down the cost of education.
Let me ask you this. The removal of the threshold, or I call it a cap, but everybody tells me I'm wrong. It's called a threshold. But the removal of the cap, the spending cap, did you support that? Or?
Well, I didn't support any of it. You know, I didn't get a vote. But you know, it really is a cap. And they... They shouldn't have. I thought they should have left it in place.
Let's go to Ben in Burlington. Ben, you're on open mic with gubernatorial candidate Phil Scott.
Yes, Lieutenant Governor, there was several attempts by the legislature to pass an ethics reform package that would have prevented public officials from bidding on state contracts, which would have directly impacted the contracts that your construction company landed with the state. This ethics bill was shot down twice in the Senate Rules Committee, which you sit on. Do you see a conflict there, or is there any response to that?
I'd just like to clarify a couple things. I don't sit on Senate Rules. I don't have a vote. I don't have anything to do with Senate Rules. That's something that they set up themselves. I'm the presiding officer over the Senate. I'm in favor of an ethics package. I always have been. I believe that we need to restore the faith and trust in what we've lost in government, and I would adhere to any rule that was passed. So I believe in an ethics package. I don't believe that we should be creating another bureaucracy. Some would advocate that we should have an ethics panel that's full-time, that year-round, millions of dollars spent on this, another level of bureaucracy. I think we can have both by doing something more the Vermont way and having a panel of some sort. And having an ethics package, I'm all in the support of an ethics package.
I want to get this one phone call, but I want to come back and ask, what is the Vermont way? Because you've mentioned it a couple of times. Let's go to Joyce in Waitsfield.
Good morning, Mike. Good morning, Lieutenant Governor. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to say thank you, Phil. I'm refreshed to hear that you're such a strong advocate for resisting the higher taxes and fees, because we can't handle any more.
I agree. I hear that every single day. You know, Vermonters are at a breaking point. They can't take anymore. And I've heard it for a few years. And we don't need to continue to raise taxes and fees on Vermonters, already overburdened families. What we need to be doing is trying to focus on the economy, trying to bring about changes so that we become more of a magnet. The last session, there's not, you know, the one that just ended, just adjourned. For the life of me, I can't find one single bill that was passed that would have a positive effect on the economy. Not one single bill within the legislature that had any meat to it whatsoever. No jobs, and that doesn't tell me that they're prioritizing on the right things. They'd rather be, you know, they're putting the cart before the horse, trying to raise taxes in order to take care of everything. And I'm saying we can take care of ourselves if we have a healthy economy.
The Vermont way, what does that mean?
It means treating people with respect and civility, listening. You know, it means we can disagree, but we can do things differently in terms of bringing everyone to the table, transparency, trying to resolve our differences in the open light. I just think it's a different way than certainly what this campaign has brought about.
Let's go to Jason in Burlington. Jason, you're on open mic.
Yeah, I just wanted to call in quickly and wish Phil a happy birthday and let him know that he's got my vote.
Well, that's great to know, Jason. Thank you very much.
One of the things that I'd be interested in your position, we've got to come back to healthcare, but a couple of things I just want to hit on. The Connecticut River dams, the hydro dams on the Connecticut River, there's a study going on right now to make a decision on whether the state should buy the Connecticut River dams. The price tag is estimated to be about $1 billion. What's your position on that?
Well, a couple things. I don't mind having a discussion about this. In fact, I wrote to some of the utility companies when this came about, and I said, maybe you should take a look at forming some sort of cooperative. Maybe you should be buying these dams and work together in trying to provide this. I am very cautious about us moving forward. First of all, I don't think we can afford it. It would affect our bond rating in this state. Secondly, we don't need to borrow any more money. We're living beyond our means right now, and putting it on the credit card isn't an option as far as I'm concerned. Secondly, we can't even run a healthcare exchange. How are we going to run a power dam? You know, this isn't something that should be within our expertise. But I think, again, maybe something to do with the utilities. If they would step up, maybe they would buy them and have some power here in the state, locally produced.
Black lives matter. All lives matter. What do you think?
Well, I think that we should be treating each other with respect and civility. I think that we should be encouraging a more diversity in the state. I grew up in Barrie, rich ethnic history there, all revolving around the economy, which is Granite. And I believe the future could bring more diversity to Vermont. But I think we should do that through the economy.
Let's go to the phone line. Let's go to Brian in Morrisville. Brian, you're on open mic with gubernatorial candidate Phil Scott.
Good morning, guys. Lieutenant Governor, one question that I would like you to address would be, what do you feel about the declining workforce participation among the 18 to 30-year-old group? We hear about demographic change, but we don't hear the declining workforce participation discussed.
Are the millennials lazy, I guess?
Well, I certainly have seen in some cases where the work ethic isn't what it used to be. We see many come across our door in the construction business. But I have to say that my faith has been renewed. We've hired some young talent this year through the company, through my campaign as well. We have a number of our youth here that are involved in the camp, very enthusiastic, very bright. We just have to find ways to keep them here. You know, we graduate 10,000 kids every year from our universities and state colleges. We need to find ways to keep them here because they're seeking opportunity, and it needs to be affordable. They need to find affordable housing. I think we do a pretty good job with low-income housing, but I think we do a terrible job in providing affordable housing for our workforce, and that's part of our problem. And again, the affordability issues, when it's not just buying a home, it's how do you pay your property taxes? Sometimes the mortgage is less than your property taxes, and that's been reversed over the years. So we have to get a handle on the costs here in the state as well as the opportunity. I think they go hand in hand, and we'll attract more businesses, more opportunity, keeping more kids here. If we play our cards right, we really, really, the opportunities are endless for us.
Your opponent, you talk about affordability. Your opponent would say, and you talk about that you're the solution, your opponent would say that you're the problem, not the solution, because you've not done anything in the last 6 years as lieutenant governor. How would you respond to that?
Well, that's offensive to me in many different ways, but I will say, I've been here my entire life. I've been slogging it out in the trenches, literally. I didn't have a political bone in my body 20 years ago. They had no interest in politics, but I started getting tired of what they then were doing to me down in Montpelier, 2 miles down the road. So I finally stepped up. I did something about it. I ran for office. And it's been an incredible experience, learned an awful lot, always served in the minority. But it's difficult. It's not easy being there. And I think that it's something that we all should do. My opponent, he moved here to Vermont in 2008 and decided that he was going to start at the top, the campaign for Vermont, I think, was just a front for running for governor. And I think that for those of us that start and work through the system, do our very best, become public servants, We need more of that. We need more people to step up. That's why, by the way, I think there should be a 90-day session. I think it goes on way too long. I don't think people that have the ability to serve, that have different ideas, step up because it goes on forever, you know? So we need to confine the length of the session.
Let's go to Rusty DeWeese. Rusty, you're on open mic with gubernatorial candidate Phil Scott.
Gentlemen, how are you?
Well, good. How are you, Rusty?
Well, good, good, Phil. Hey, I'm listening to you guys. Always a pleasure, Mike. And, Phil, you're sounding like $1 million. And I just have a prediction for the listeners that when they vote you in as governor, and I go around a lot like you do, Phil, the state, and I hear a lot from Democrats, Republicans, all different type of people. This is what they say. They say, boy, that Jim Douglas was something else, wasn't he? He's a nice guy, but he did some good things. I'm hearing that a lot. And I predict that when they vote you in for governor, however many years you stay in there, that's what you're going to be hearing about Phil Scott. Not because of what you're going to do for the state, do it the Vermont way, but because of the kind of guy you are. And it's coming across on the radio. And I'll leave it to that because I'm down here and I got to get gas, head out to Burlington, do some work myself. See you later, Phil.
See you later, Rusty.
Well, thank you very much, Rusty, and I appreciate that. You know, I do feel like I'm the only candidate running for governor who's truly in touch with everyday Vermonters and understands the challenge they face and knows what it's like to live paycheck to paycheck. It's something that I've grown up with. I've literally started from the bottom up, and I think that that's important, and understanding that it's public service, not this isn't a position.
Tom, I'm going to try to get one more phone call in here before we move on to other issues. Let's go to Bob in East Montpelier. Bob, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Yeah, Phil. I just had a question. I'm not really kind of clear on it from the mileage tax. Are you for or against it?
Against it.
Okay.
Against the adding the mileage tax to anything in Vermont. You know, I'm not in favor of adding any burden to already overtaxed Vermonters. If they want to do something on the national level to address this concern that we're going to have in the future, I think that's where it should be handled, on the federal level, nationally. And it's something they're talking about in Congress. But I'm not advocating to do anything different here in Vermont. I think, again, we've had enough of these experiments over the years, and that's part of what the problem is, whether it's GMOs or whether it's single payer or whether it's anything else. We don't need any more experimentation. What we need to do is get back to the basics, the fundamentals, live within our means, grow the economy, make Vermont more affordable so our kids can stay here, you know, and we'll be a magnet for new kids coming here. So the future is bright. Again, we have to get a handle on what we're spending.
Syrian refugees, should we bring them in?
I've said this before. I think Rutland is an example of what they're doing. I think the process was flawed, to be honest. I have a deep amount of compassion for our Syrian refugees, any refugee that's coming from these war-torn countries. But I think the people of Rutland have some legitimate concerns, and they should be answered. We should be doing it in a transparent process. We should be educating people. We should be having these forums to talk about these tough issues. And affordability is a problem. So I think the mayor has now established some sort of cabinet. He probably should have done that to begin with, and maybe we could have avoided some of this. But again, I believe that we need to think about legal immigration as part of the answer for the future, about creating more diversity, about building the economy. But I think that, again, public safety comes first. That's first and foremost in any government, and that should be a priority. So we have to think about public safety, but we also should be transparent and have these tough conversations.
Why should Vermonters support you in the Republican primary?
Well, again, I think I'm the only candidate that understands what it's like to be here in Vermont. I've lived here my entire life. I'm a blue-collar worker. Very proud of my blue-collar roots, by the way. But I appreciate. I've listened and learned from Vermonters throughout my last 5 or 6 years. I've done the Vermont Everyday Jobs Tour, where I've worked a day in somebody else's shoes, 35 jobs throughout Vermont. I'm in touch with Vermont. I can feel what needs to be done. And I'm the person that can do it. You know, I'm the only candidate standing in the way of the Democrats taking over or retaining the seat and a new vision for Vermont. And I believe I'm part of the answer.
One last question, and I know this is unfair. Got about 30 seconds. Minimum wage, $15. You support it or not?
I'm in favor of Vermonters making more money. I am in favor of everyone making more money, but I believe it's through a healthier economy. And I don't think the raising, this artificial raising of the minimum wage, is just going to increase the cost of living. I'm concerned about those Main Street businesses. I'm concerned about the small mom and pops. And I think that this would just ratchet up the cost of living. Those that are making, like in my business, those that are making $15 an hour, if it's raised to 15, will want to make 18. Those making 18 will want to make 21. Those making 21 will make 24. So this just ratchets up the cost of living. Let's grow the economy.
I want to thank you for coming in.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's Phil Scott, candidate for governor. Up next, Bruce Listman, another Republican candidate for governor. And, of course, I want to thank you all for your phone calls. Tomorrow, just a preview, it's going to be Free for All Friday, your phone calls. This is Open Mic, and you are listening to locally owned and operated WDEV News Radio on the Friendly Pioneer, celebrating its 85th year anniversary this year, celebrating the future, actually. WDEV AM 550 broadcasting from Waterbury and Montpelier, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, and serving the kingdom at 101.9 FM from Island Pond. And of course, we're streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. Mike Smith, be right back. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. It's my pleasure to welcome to Open Mic Victoria Jones from Talk Media News. Good morning, Victoria.
Good morning.
One of, let's start out with Donald Trump. I guess I guess everybody is starting out with Donald Trump this morning. Here's a question that I think most Republicans are wondering right now. What does the party look like after Donald Trump is done with it?
Oh, you think he's going to be done with it?
No, not in that regard. In one way or the other, either he wins or loses. The party is going to look, different, isn't it?
Yeah, oh, absolutely, absolutely. I think it's going to look like a piece of meat.
What, the one thing that is critical in these elections, especially on the down tickets, are sort of the loyalty of the top of the ticket sort of kind of having their back. And yet you have Kelly Ayotte, who's in a tough, tough race in New Hampshire, getting trashed by the top of their ticket, Donald Trump. What does that do to the party?
It doesn't do anything for morale, and it doesn't do anything to Kelly Ayotte, although I'm not sure that it hurts her in New Hampshire. Well, it doesn't help anybody to be called weak. And I've noticed that he calls women weak. He calls Hillary Clinton weak. Does he call men weak? Yes, he calls Barack Obama weak. I'm not sure how many other men he calls weak, but this is one of his insults. But particularly for women, he likes to call women weak. And he called Kelly Ayotte disloyal. But Kelly Ayotte as you know so much better than I do, being neighbors, is in a tough race with Maggie Hassan. So she's been, you know, running to the center, and she was very condemnatory of Trump's attacks on the Khans, particularly his attack on Khan's wife. So I'm not sure that it hurts her as much as it hurts some of the other people, because she has been going to the center. But what it does to the party is it shows them to be fractured.
You know, this is just me, but loyalty to me is a big deal. Whether it's loyalty to superiors or loyalty to subordinates, it's a big deal. And one of the things that I'm wondering, if Trump isn't loyal to those Republicans, then why should Republicans be loyal to him?
Well, you see, that's the thing, and I'm not sure that he's thought this one through. Well, I'm not sure that he thinks things through anyway. I don't think he thinks like that. You see, one of the, you know, I'll go back to this alleged intervention that Reince Priebus, the chair of the RNC, was supposedly having with Newt Gingrich and Rudy Giuliani. Sources who seem to be in the know are saying that, well, they're not even sure that that would work with Trump, because now that he's got through the Republican convention, according to people who know, some some one or two people who know him are saying he doesn't feel like he needs the Republicans anymore, the top Republicans anymore, because he's through the convention now.
Let's switch subjects because we could probably go on all day about this. But did the United States pay a ransom to Iran?
Well, I'm not sure that they paid a ransom to for what was an arms deal back in 1979 that was a failed arms deal around the time of the fall of the Shah. Has been going on apparently intermittently for 35 years. And we didn't pay them for the, you know, we owed them money. And it was about to go to The Hague. Now, I don't know whether it was going to court. I think it was going to court in The Hague. And it was widely expected by everybody, including the United States, that we were going to lose there. And if we lost, the United States would have had to pay a phenomenal amount of 35 years interest, which would could have added up to about $10 billion, not a billion or so, or $1.7 billion, I think, is the amount that we owed. So the Obama administration felt that let's settle with them now. We don't want to pay them $10 billion. If this thing goes to court in The Hague, we're going to end up paying them $10 billion, and it will have been decided in court publicly. We're not going to have a choice. Let's make the deal. So they made the deal, and they pay. Now, was it smart to pay it in? You know, they don't have a banking arrangement with Iran, so they paid it in cash. Is what they said. Could they have wired it? You would think so. They paid it in cash. Was it smart to pay it at the same time as the Americans came out? No.
Victoria, as always, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Victoria Jones, Talk Media News. Coming up, Bruce Lissman, Republican candidate for governor. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. It's my pleasure to have in studio with me today is Republican candidate for governor, Bruce Lissman. Good morning, Bruce.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you. If you have any comments, questions, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. I'd ask you to wait a minute so that we can get into some of the subjects before you start calling in. Last time you were here, Bruce, that was May 5th, and you said this.
And the same thing with Donald Trump. What's the big deal? I promise you I'll have a decision soon enough.
You said before the convention, but does that seems like a political answer. Is there something that can happen way before the convention?
Yeah. Okay. No, earlier on I said I would have an answer before the convention. What I've just said in a release, which I didn't think to bring with me, is next few days. I don't know what that means either, but next few days. Soon enough.
Do you have an answer?
No. I'm watching just like you are and everyone else is. This is a fascinating picture, if you will. So the fellow's rise to fame and the nomination relates directly, I think, to Americans' complete dissatisfaction with what's taking place in Washington. And nobody predicted, I don't know that you did, but I can guess most of the media did not. But I certainly didn't. And then, so we're fascinated when he takes on the real issues of Washington and think, whoa, that's interesting. That's what I think. And then he follows it up with a off message, almost dismaying comment that puts us back off again, which is exactly where I am. Of course, the conflict is that he's the candidate of my party, and he won a significant number of votes. And but I'm watching just like you are. It's a fairly fascinating reality show.
But on that May 5th cut that we just played, you said you'd promise to have an answer.
I don't. And so I would do my best to come up with one. Certainly, eventually, we vote in November. So right now, I'm watching. I guess I had imagined that he would sort of coalesce the issues and focus on the important matters of the day And if he had done that, of course, I already would have I would have said someplace I'm going to support him. But I'm watching, surprised at how it's gone.
Here's the problem. Because you take that clip, you listen to what you have just said, and you tout that you're not the usual politician. But it really sounds like you're being a politician here because you're not answering one way or the other on this question.
Well, I think I'm an ordinary person in the sense of whether you're a politician or not, sometimes you have to wait and watch and see what happens. I have said that I'm not the usual politician. I'm not the usual guy. I don't think I'm a politician, for one thing. I think I'm like a lot of other people. Even those who have supported him are now offering up, they're starting to back away from it. Rather than do that, I just thought I'd see how it lays out.
You had mentioned that people in politics, people don't like what's happening in politics, part of the appeal of Trump. There are two sides to that coin, and Bernie Sanders brought this up too. The economic aspect of it, people are frustrated. They've lost confidence in the financial structure of our capitalistic society. Those are in polls. Banks have their approval ratings have plummeted.
Congress, low level of approval.
Institutions. You come from one side of that sector, which is the financial sector. Aren't you part of the problem instead of part of the solution?
Well, no, you should know better. Because I've said to you on numerous occasions, you must be my playback the last time you asked me this question. So what I've said is I started off as a file clerk. I didn't have a degree that got me started at an executive level. It's like being in the mailroom someplace. And not only that, but I drove a taxi and was a bartender in my early days in New York, which is, by the way, a career by mistake since I hadn't intended to get into it. And it wasn't long after becoming a file clerk, years, I started to manage people, and then I managed more people, and then managed what was an orphaned division, which was stocks. And when I was given the title of co-head, the fellow said, don't hurt us or something, or don't do anything dangerous. As if nothing mattered. 21 years later, I grew it into a business that was $2.3 billion and was successful and highly, and I thought in the best way, liked and beloved by our client base because I hired people with talent. I built the best technology we could afford, and I serviced clients at a level we're not used to in America, and I did it all with a simple strategic plan of putting the client at the center. It had literally nothing to do with the financial crisis since we did our own thing in stocks, a very conventional business. And mind you, business was profitable right to the end. What J.P. Morgan got when they bought our firm was my division and, of course, a few other things.
There's usually a risk committee within the company. Did you sit on the risk committee?
No, I didn't.
And why? Because usually senior vice presidents sit on the risk committee.
I don't know what a senior vice president is, but usually is a nice term. I didn't because in my business we didn't take any risk.
The risk committee usually looks at the overall company, not just the one division. That's why they have certain people from different divisions on a risk committee. So you weren't on a risk committee.
How many times would you like me to say this? So I was not on a risk committee until the very end, in the last probably 90 days when the company was reorganized in terms of management, and I went on a risk committee. It's the first and only time.
Let's switch to local.
Do you want to ask, Mike, do you want to ask that question again? Because I did not serve on the risk committee until the end.
Okay, what do you want me to ask in this?
Well, I was trying to. So you've raised an important issue here. Did I serve on the risk committee? And my answer was I did not, until the very end of the firm. In which case, of course, last 90 days probably didn't matter in retrospect. I'm just trying to get at your question. So where are you heading with it? Because I've said no. I said no twice. So
well, that's what I was asking. You said no.
I thought you were heading some other place. Go ahead.
What other place would I be heading?
I was asking you. I didn't want to leave the subject until you were satisfied.
The one thing that I want to turn to is wind, because the Democrats have been talking a lot about wind this week. What's your position on industrial wind, citing industrial wind projects?
Yeah, I've said from the beginning I don't like it, and asked for a moratorium as a better place to begin. I've I think a good democracy reflects the will of the majority but protects those in a minority position. In this case, I thought our whole siting process was one in which people in communities and people themselves were not being listened to. So I didn't think it worked well. So I proposed a moratorium to come up with better siting, fairer siting rules. Really, I think this is outsized to what we should be doing in Vermont, and I think we need Vermont-scale type renewables, rooftops, and other things, but not big wind. The problem is, just simply saying I'm against it is that there's some significant group of people in Vermont who still want it, and thus I think we ought to have rules that are fair, borrowed from other countries and other states.
I'm not sure I understand that. So let me just go back and ask that question. So there would be some allowable wind in a Lissman administration, industrial wind on rooftops, on ridgelines.
No, I've said no. I don't like them. Right now we have a group of people in Vermont who still think it's the right thing to do. I don't. I prefer scale to the size of our state. What I've said is, if we're going to go forward at all, we need a moratorium to choose siting rules that reduce the effect. Right now, it's just a land grab. This is all about money being transferred from taxpayers and ratepayers to developers. And what I think we need to do is reduce the rate of return so it's not a land grab. And frankly, that's the best way to slow this down. So I don't favor them. I'm just trying to find a way. And I'd prefer not to do them, but I'm also trying to find a way to do a regulatory structure that limits the returns and therefore the land grab aspect of this.
We've seen some people complain that the Public Service Board process is broken. Do you believe it's broken? And if so, how would you fix it?
It's a creature of the legislature, so we need a different kind of regulatory regime. And the legislature needs to get off the notion that there's not a, every square piece of land deserves some kind of big renewable. I think we need a process that is more clearly fair, so that you, a citizen who might be in a small town, has a right to access the process and not require a major law firm to help you out. Many would be beyond the scale of what a local community can do. So, but we also need rules that make it fair. It's not a fair process today.
Would you blow it up or the process?
What does that mean?
That means change it completely.
Well, we're going to have the opportunity to change the chair of the Public Service Board. But we also need to ensure that they are protected by, if you will, a strategic plan that does not say, that says there's a judicial process that works for people, fair process. I really don't think industrial wind makes a lot of sense for our state. And it's proven when we have a big Spanish company proposing a very outsized project in Grafton, in Grafton area. And the problem with looking at that and saying that doesn't work is, and this one does, is that you've already opened the doors. And that's why we need to reduce the returns by making rules. So, for example, in other countries, if the value of your property has declined because of the nearby wind tower, the developer is obliged to make up that value, just as an example of what takes place elsewhere.
Pro-choice, pro-life?
Pro-choice.
Gun control. What's your position on gun control?
I think we have laws sufficient for our state. I'm a firm defender of Second Amendment rights.
Have you ever supported a ban on assault rifles?
I haven't.
What? And so you would make no changes to the existing laws?
No.
As governor?
Ensure that we enforce what we have.
Last time you were here, and I know we got a lot of phone calls. We'll get to the phone calls in just a moment. Last time you were here, we turned to the subject of health care, and we both got into the weeds on this,
yes,
this issue. So I want to back up a little bit and revisit this question. If you could design a health care system that would sort of guarantee access, affordability, and quality, what would that look like?
Yeah, I'm glad you said it, because one of the regrets I had in that interview, we were so deep in the weeds I could barely see my shoes. Step back for a second. I think what we need is a robust healthcare system. We want maximum access, so if you need healthcare, you can find it. I think we need competition. I'd like to think about the employer for a moment. if you had an employer, he might care or she might care more about your health than you do. Oftentimes we are our own worst enemy. And why? Because that person is paying your, if you're connected to the business, that person is paying for your health care. So ironically, that person cares more about your health than you might. 80 to 90% of all the visits to the emergency room, doctor visits, and the pharmacy relate to how we behave ourselves, whether it's the right food, whether we smoke or drink, whether we take drugs we shouldn't, or even if we take the medicines we're supposed to when prescribed. And that tells you the kind of preventative care and wellness care that we could put together in our state using designated agencies who are deep in the communities who can really help people who are not working for others. We need to do a couple things. First, healthcare itself, Mike, is only growing at a rate of about 2% a year. Our insurance, which is how you and I measure the cost of healthcare, is rising at 10 to 20% a year, depending on where you are. And in our state, we have very high premiums and high deductibles. So what to do about that? Well, one, let's move off Healthcare Connect, move to the federal exchange, and stop spending a lot of money on something that will never work. Second, do a deep dive audit of Medicaid. It's a third of our fellow Vermonters are in it. We don't know enough about it. It hasn't been audited since 2011. And I think we need to understand who's in there, of course, whether they're eligible or not, but also whether they're using the right benefits and whether the expensive benefits are being used. It is such a large number that is literally squeezing our budget on the one hand. It is a large administrative process. It's a complicated process. And at the top of it, of course, is pushing insurance premiums up. So those are the kind of things I would get to in a hurry.
Let's go to the phone lines. Let's go to Henry in Burlington. Henry, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Yeah, I just want to ask Mr. Listman why he has donated money to Hillary Clinton in the past.
Thank you, Henry.
Yes, sir. Also, just to point out, I gave money to John McCain and others, Republicans as well. In those cases, in that time, clients, people I respected, would come ask, would you attend a meeting for a candidate that I favor or we favor, and oftentimes would say, I don't want to attend or I can't, and you know, can we simply make a contribution?
Jay in Northfield. Jay, you're on open mic with gubernatorial candidate Bruce Listman.
Thank you for your time, Mr. Listman. I had a question about some information that I've seen on Campaign for Vermont comments on Facebook, and I'm questioning if the information is accurate here that says while at Bears and Stearns, you were part of a sexual harassment and gender discrimination lawsuit. Could you speak to that a little bit and what your role was in that?
Sure. I've heard that out there. Well, let me be clear. So I've never been investigated nor charged nor anything else related to sexual harassment or any kind of gender or age issue. I can tell you that explicitly because we submitted voluntarily to a Labor Department audit whether we pay fairly based on age, gender, and other issues. And the disclaimer, the statement I made, signed, there's never been an internal investigation or inquiry, external investigation or inquiry, arbitration or litigation, finding or a regulatory administrative agency review, or any investigation has found that I engaged in any discriminatory treatment of behavior over 20, back then it was 17 years. The other things I would say is, first, to tell you how I managed my own business. We had mandatory monthly meetings, all hands, to talk about how we should behave. I had a zero tolerance. We have a due diligence process, but in many cases I said, I've seen enough, you have to leave. And third, of course, we submitted to an audit to measure how we did. The case you're referring to is 2001. It was thrown out by the courts, and it was denied in an arbitration process. It happened in a Boston office. I worked in New York. There were literally four layers of management between that individual who made the claim and me. It didn't relate to me. It's simply a lot of names were put in the front page of it.
Let's go to Marcia in Waterbury. Marcia, you're on open mic.
Hi, my name is Marcia. I retired just this past year from working most 37 years for the state of Vermont in the Agency of Human Services. And I just want to make a comment that I'm really disappointed in how this campaign has been run with the negativity, and I would hope that people in human services wouldn't be treated with that same negativity and that same attitude.
Bruce?
Sure. Well, thanks for your statement. I really appreciate that you're paying attention to the campaigns. Well, I have a different view. I think that we should be discussing the issues. I've never said a single thing about Phil Scott, the person, the man he is or the man he would like to be. I've simply, nor have I done any research about him. But what I've said are, here are the issues. Here's what he said and when he said it and where he said it. And here's what I believe. And it's a contrast that I could best describe as the opportunity to think bigger than what's going to happen in 16 and think about what will be like in 2026. So, Mike, you'll be 10 years older then, hopefully right here in the show, but you will...
I won't.
Don't say that now. I'm just liking the show a lot. So the other side of it is that I think in America, in Vermont, we're talking about, we should be talking about the issues and what kind of issues I present and what we believe in, because I think we need a change in direction, and I believe conviction matters, urgency matters, but leadership is an action step and requiring real movement. So that's why I tell you what I believe in, and that's why we've shown you the contrast between me and my opponent, Lieutenant Governor Scott. It's as simple as that. I have never called him a name. I might add he's called me a whole bunch of names recently.
I want to get back to that issue in just a moment, but we have to take a break. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. In studio with me is Republican candidate for governor, Bruce Listman, and we're going to continue our discussion and your phone calls. If you wish to join the conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to John in Williston. John, you're on Open Mic with gubernatorial candidate Bruce Listman.
Hi. I only have three things to say. One is, Mr. Listman, I think you're running a dirty campaign. And two is Phil Scott's, all Phil Scott's supporters. I don't believe you're going to beat him. But if you happen to beat him, I hope they all turn and vote Democrat, because any one of the three Democrats would be better in office than you. Thank you.
How do you respond?
Well, I hope if I win that you'll support me, because I think both Republicans are better than any of the three Democrats. But I understand emotion can run high about an election. I have a feeling you might reflect on that and think differently. Again, I'm glad you're asking a second question on this, because I'm running a campaign that is designed to tell you how I see things and how he sees things. And I can only do that through what he has said. It's factually correct. All the quotes are real. They're all dated. You can find them on your own in Google, where we found them. And the whole point is, so what do you stand for? And how are we going to change this nature of the state? When we talk about a change of direction, which Vermonters tell me every single day is what they want, and I'm guessing, John, that's what you might want, what does that mean? Where are we now? How do we get to where we want to go? And what is it that we're trying to achieve? So when we started this campaign, I was known by probably five people in my immediate family, and probably 60 points behind him. He's been in eight election cycles, 10 years in the Senate, six as lieutenant governor, extremely well known. And sometimes we take for granted that we know somebody's positions. My view is I look at people and say, well, what have you done? Not just what you've said. What have you done? And I found fault in things he didn't do. Stand up and say on behalf of the people, these are ideas are crazy and wrong. As a member of the cabinet, he could have said, I'm in the cabinet. I don't have any power to change things, so I'm going to step out of the cabinet and tell you these are nutty ideas. And I think he should have, and he would have been our hero. He's the senior most elected Republican, John, and I think he could have done more for you and me.
Let me ask you this. If you win the primary, undoubtedly the campaign ads that are going to come at you is about your connection to Wall Street and the collapse in 2008. Is that fair?
I think anything is fair. And because I know you and like you doesn't mean that I know everything about you. But if we're electing you, maybe as much as you can show is what you ought to. I have to say to all of you listening, am wondering. I'm proud of my career on Wall Street. It is part of my personal history. I performed well starting literally, if there was a bottom, I was below the bottom. The fellow I worked for filing papers thought my college education was an impediment to my future in his department. He was right, because I was reading this stuff. I was proud of the fact that I took an orphan business that did $50 million a year and ranked 26th out of 28 firms, I think. I could be off by a few, which is to say in last place. And 21 years later was a $2.3 billion business and was viewed by the clients as an exceptional vendor. I'm proud of the people I hired, whether they're 18 or 23 or 35 years old or even 75 years old, because they performed fantastically, and I was honest with them. This is what I think of you. Twice a year I'd say that, but tell me what you think of me.
Let's go to Rich in Starkesboro. Rich, I've got full phone line, so if we can get right to the point, I would certainly appreciate it.
One quick. Bruce, for many years, your voice has been on the radio talking about transparency through Campaign for Vermont Prosperity, and I repeat the word transparency. In your ad about Phil Scott and the mileage tax, were you being transparent and just having a little segment? I don't know Phil Scott personally. He does not know me, but I believe his conversation was relating to the cars that get a lot of miles per gallon and don't pay much in taxes for fuel, and the revenues are going down because 50 and 60 mile an hour cars, miles per gallon cars, are on the road and they're not putting in the money for repairing the roads. They do the same amount of damage. Can you give us the context in that? You want to be transparent with us, please?
Sure, and I think I am transparent with you, more so than certainly any other candidate. Well, he did say it, and it's on our website, the full tape. You can see all or any part of it. I thought certain that he would put something out that would modify it. We didn't put our own release out for 16 full hours. The next time we'd run into each other on Channel 17 in a debate, he took it up again and pressed me and said, well, if we don't do this, how are we going to pay for the highways? Also, you can find that. And so, forgetting for a moment what you wished he said, it is what he said. What he says now, I don't know.
Let's suppose that come Tuesday night, Phil Scott wins the primary. Would you support him?
Absolutely, because I think he's the second best candidate, but we are the first best party.
Let's go to Greg in Manchester. Greg, you're on open mic with Bruce Lisman.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call. I just had a very quick question. I heard Bruce on the on a debate the other night talk about how he hasn't heard Vermonters ask him about Trump on the campaign trail.
I have not.
Before I go to the polls on Tuesday, I want to know if you're going to support Trump. If you continue to refuse to answer, I'm going to have to vote for Phil. That's my question.
Sure. Well, he's against Trump, and he's been straightforward. And I've been straightforward saying this is not the easiest candidate to love. And so I'm watching pretty carefully. Honestly, I don't hear much from – I don't hear at all from Vermonters about it. They're very focused on Vermont and our own needs, and my campaign is entirely dedicated to changing the direction of our state. Vermonters say nobody listens to me, that my property taxes have been high, too high for a long time, that the cost to live here is high, that the cost to employ others is too high. And I've been talking about this, but no one listens. And I like to listen. I'd rather listen to you than, frankly, to me. And I think we can do something about it. And really, they don't spend a lot of time on national politics except to wave it off.
Tom, I'm going to go to John in Callis, and then we're going to take a quick break, and we'll come in back with other phone calls. John from Callis, you're on with Bruce Lisman, Republican candidate for governor.
Thank you. Two quick things. One, the caller before about the mileage tax was on the right track. My question would be, one, as people move further and further towards electric cars that don't pay any gas tax, well, how would you propose to maintain our infrastructure? And two, on a personal note, could you please stop with the robocalls? I've lost count of how many I've got at my house. I'm just tired of hearing them. Thanks.
Thanks, John, for the phone call. John actually asked a question that I was on my list here. How would you pay for transportation infrastructure, given that Tesla and others are moving towards electric cars? How would you pay for maintaining our roads?
So I'm watching with interest a more national debate on this. Both candidates have talked about infrastructure as important to growing the economy. Since Dwight Eisenhower first proposed the highway system, there have been discussions in Washington about how to pay for it. Even when it was only gas and only 8 miles a gallon, they were discussing alternatives. Nothing ever happened. In 07, the discussion about having an infrastructure center in the government began taking on, I think, some serious amount of traction. Certainly the recession got in the way of that, and it's back again. So my guess is that we're going to have some kind of infrastructure effort that would enable states to borrow cheaply to fund future expansion and maintenance. Will it happen? It's hard to say. But these candidates are talking about it, and even Speaker of House has begun speaking about alternatives like that. And my guess is the solution is going to be remarkably different.
But isn't that a tax?
Well, everything's a tax. There's nothing free. So I don't think I can make a change in Washington about how they should do this and what they should have done in the last 20 years to anticipate the changes they wanted. But I think there's going to be some kind of – I call it an infrastructure bank because that's what two different parties have called it over the years. How it's going to work and what it means, I don't know. The 2007 bipartisan plan would have had the government borrow significant money and would still be doing that matching system they do now. It would just supplement federal funds.
Boy, I could spend about a half hour on that, but I gotta move on.
I would spend a half an hour saying there must be a better way than that.
Let's, Tom, here's what I'm going to do. Jennifer, if you just would hold on for a minute, we're going to go to break. Tom, let's take a break, and then we'll come back. We'll take Jennifer as our first call. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith in studio with us this morning, and we're discussing politics. It's Bruce Lissman, a Republican candidate for governor. Jennifer, I promised you I'd come right back to you. Jennifer from South Burlington, you're on Open Mic. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Just want to say I've been following the campaign, and I do appreciate the specific plans and proposals put forth by Mr. Lissman and being straightforward when speaking to folks. And I'm just wondering if you can speak about what your approach to our opiate addiction crisis would be.
Yes, we do have a crisis. It's a great equalizer, and it's impacting our lives every which way. So I'll just be really brief. The best program, best programs in America do roughly the following four or five things. One is you need one person in charge of it, so that person takes full responsibility and the burden of getting things done. Second, we need to be a well-policed state in the community but also visible. We need to have a preventative program which includes marketing to those who might consider this as well as those who would prescribe. We need a judicial system that understands the difference between a hardened criminal, no catch and release, and those who need intervention. We need the capacity to intervene when you're ready. So when you say, I need help, we need to be able to give it to you, because if we wait too long, you might die or you might overdose again. And then finally, we need a more robust mental health system, because oftentimes there's a fabulous, if you will, intersection of mental health as well as addiction issues. And I might add, we need to get to the prison population, which is too large, bring them back to the state, bring them back to our state, but we need to intervene with them 6 months before they're released because there's 25% of them with mental health issues, 25% have opiate addiction background. So that's what I would do.
I'm going to go to Mike and Barry, Tom. But Mike, if you could make it very brief, we're starting to run out of time, and I still have phone calls to get through.
Yeah, excuse me. I just wanted to address some of the unfortunate statements made against Mr. Lissman. I don't like the words dirty campaign and the negativity campaign thing, which was coined back in the first Bush administration, the Willie Horton thing, has become a knee-jerk mantra for so many people. I think Mr. Lissman's pointing out things about Phil Scott's political involvement in this administration is legitimate, and it informed me because I did not know Mr. Scott was so cozy with his failed administration that was almost run out of office by a complete unknown last time around. And I support him,
and I am very disappointed in these knee-jerk calls. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Mike. Bruce, I'm not going to ask you to respond to that. He pretty much summed it up. And
thank you, but thank you very much.
Let's go to Bennington. Bennington, you're on open mic with gubernatorial candidate Bruce Lisman.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on. This is Thomas Joseph, and fraud is very important to me because I'm the federal whistleblower involved with the Brattleboro retreat. I have one quick question for Mr. Lisman. He has willingly accepted campaign contributions from those who were previously involved in a $75 million scheme on Wall Street. His name is Richard Harrison. And Mr. Jasper Craven, an accomplished journalist with Vermont Digger, confirmed that. But like everything else, Mr. Lisman doesn't like scrutiny of his own record. And I'd like to hear Mr. Lisman's explanation for why he can so willingly embrace fraudsters. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the question. We returned his check. Thanks.
Let's go to minimum wage. You for it or against it?
Well, we need minimum wage. Are you asking if it should go to a level? So we're tied to the standard.
$15 minimum
wage. No. So what I've said is gradual increases over time, and that's the cost of living. We already have that.
You can tell I'm rushing because I meant to say $15
million. That's okay.
$15 minimum wage.
I wanted to be sure you weren't asking me if we need one.
Syrian refugees.
Yes. Compassion.
Good or bad?
Well, I've said no, and I've said no because if the FBI can't say out loud we're 100% certain, then I'm not an expert. I say let's go with them. And we can have success in bringing refugees here, and we have, and but for the Syrians, no, we're having a hard time verifying them.
EB-5 program, for or against?
Well, if done right without fraud, it's, I think, a great way of raising capital on quite a limited scale. We have hotels up at JP Peak, and things are there. Sadly, how it happened is all bad. It makes us all feel bad for it.
Why should Vermonters support you in the Republican primary?
Well, I hope they do. Thanks for asking me. Well, I think people are saying everywhere, my country is in the wrong direction, but our state is really in the wrong direction. And no one listens to me. I am very clear on what I believe in and the issues that I think are important. I do believe that leadership is an action statement. I believe ideas in America matter, and that the stronger, well-researched ideas they are and the bigger they are, the more we want to follow them. And they provide an outline for action. But I believe urgency matters because it's hard to get things done. I think I can take our state in a different direction. And so, Mike, I think in all the candidates you've had here, I'm the single one who's an outsider. I'm very transparent, very open on matters.
Bruce Lisman, thank you very much.
It's great to see you again. Thank you so much.
Bruce Lisman, Republican candidate for governor. I want to thank him and also Phil Scott, the other Republican candidate for governor. And, of course, all of you. A lot of phone calls today. I really appreciate that. Tomorrow, it's Free for All Friday. 2 hours of your phone calls on any subject that you would like. This is Open Mic, and you are listening to locally owned and operated WDEV Radio News Radio on the Friendly Pioneer, celebrating its 85th year anniversary this year. Celebrating the future, 85 years, WDEV News Radio, WDEV AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury and Montpelier, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, and serving the kingdom at 101.9 FM from Island Pond. Of course, we're streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com.
The Open Mic Podcast is brought to you by Hickok Boardman, Dennis Ricker, and Brown.
Find us online at hbinsurance.com, and you're always welcome to visit us on Facebook, in Vermont, online, on the phone. Hickok and Boardman Insurance Group. We are here when you need us.